I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What the Yes, I Can president wanted more than anything was to bring together a robust democracy in spirit and substance.
We are one people. We are one nation. And together, we will begin the next great chapter in the American story with three words that will ring from coast to coast, from sea to shining sea. Yes, we can. Thank you, New Hampshire.
What he ran into was a rock slide of revolt and a singular embodiment of it, a three-ring circus of a successor, Donald Trump, chosen, it seems, to be the very opposite in tone and temperament of Barack Obama. How's to account for what we missed and what we're going to miss? On Boston Common this week, feelings were all over the lot.
Oh my God, I cry because I think about imagining he's leaving. So it's really sad. It's a, you know, makes me want to throw up a little in my mouth.
Probably the worst in my lifetime. The last 8 years were horrible. Thank God he's out.
You know, I mean, it's hard to do a perfect job at anything like that. I think he did a great job, given the circumstances, and I think what he's leaving us with as far as the hope for the future is the most important thing.
I mean, the press did a really good job in showing him as a really good person. I would give it like a B+.
I agree so much more with Obama than Trump that it's hard to see the bad in Obama right now.
In the highlight reels, my favorite moment might have been just a few words Obama spoke introducing himself to a massive crowd of Germans in Berlin's Central Park in July of the campaign summer 2008.
Although tonight I speak to you not as a candidate for president, but as a citizen. A proud citizen of the United States and a fellow citizen of the world.
It sounded, I thought, like a transnational promise to redeem the war in Iraq. That was before Barack Obama was elected. And then what happened? Our guest, Marilyn Robinson, of Idaho originally, then Iowa, is the best-selling storyteller of the heartland, the Pulitzer Prize novelist of Housekeeping, Gilead, and Home. With her devoted reader, President Obama himself, she chanced into a series of intimate conversations that made unusual reading, not about politics so much as the spirit of the country and the core of the man in the White House. So she was the first person we wanted to ask about what we're losing in this transition. In a farewell piece in The Nation magazine, she made no bones about saying President Obama has been the very best of us.
He's an amazing man. He has a kind of deep residual joy that I think is his great strength. He not only recovers, he recovers the ability to be generous and the ability to be gracious. I think he really is a saintly man. I don't think that's an overstatement at all.
Your thread in the Farewell in the Nation was that, you know, he was the best of us. He was the embodiment of the American idea, literally and spiritually, a model really of that more perfect union he kept speaking about to you as his ideal. A man who had Kansan origins, who lived in a stranger in Indonesia, who had family living today in Kenya. The very embodiment of the transnational idea.
I don't know why this country, where people pride themselves really on having traveled, having had as much sort of broadening experience as they were able to have. This is true of a great many Americans. And yet, somehow or other, the fact that someone spent part of his childhood in a foreign country was treated like something threatening and alienating. How do we do that to ourselves? It's embarrassing, you know? Our refusal to acknowledge him as he was really is a refusal to acknowledge ourselves as we are, including a country that lives very deeply into the world, is very inseparable from the world at large.
That was my understanding of him, certainly coming in. It seemed to me the most exciting thing about this country of immigrants, this nation of immigrants, and I'm one of them, family of, was this same excitement about him. As wonderfully multiple, it seemed to me, in 2008, as the crew of Melville's Pequod. A nation.
Yes.
Before we had a government.
Right. When you watch what's going on now, and you have a president-elect who really has gone to the Soviet Union or Russia a number of times, you know, to try to kind of shake loose some rubles and so on, that we're not supposed to be so alarmed about as the fact that Obama spent some tiny part of his childhood in a foreign school. I mean, that's just ridiculous. The country should blush collectively for having been distracted by these issues that are not issues.
Mm. Marilyn, you celebrate this man, and I think every word of it resonates. Incredibly alert, attentive, listening ahead of your next sentence, engaged, extraordinarily bright. But there's a gap between the man and his movement, and it's a big puzzle. The movement became almost bigger than him, and then suddenly he seemed to leave it outside the door at the White House. That's a puzzlement to me, the loner.
I've watched a lot of elections at this point, and I remember Barack Obama, when he was running for office, saying, we will be able to do this and this and this because I have a movement behind me, you know, talking to the audience. Cheers, cheers. A liberal politician never has a movement behind him. It is simply true, historically, that their attention and their devotion can be deflected instantly. I think that the hopes that Obama had were realistic intrinsically and very much possible of realization. But people, they go running off after crazy things, you know, the newspapers every day talking about his birth certificate, this kind of stuff.
Yeah, perfectly awful.
The distractibility of the people who ought to have been his supporters was what was really his weakness. I think that was a great hard lesson for him to absorb. This idea of the transformative leader, I think that Obama is smarter than that. He knows that change is incremental and that it is collective and that what liberals tend to do, and I call myself a liberal under every possible circumstance, I put it on my headstone, but what they tend to do is create some ideal that nobody could live up to and then diminish what is good, what is accomplished, by comparison with this almost childlike supposed expectation. It's no way to run anything.
Eric Foner said that President Obama didn't listen hard or learn much from his critics. I want to know what he learned from his friends, like you, Marilyn.
I think from me he learned how much he loved what he actually loved before. I think that he has an idea of America that's inclusive in the sense that it goes all the way from anyone's ordinary life to, you know, the highest articulated values of the Constitution and the Declaration. He loves the country as a phenomenon, and he is able to absorb all kinds of things that, frankly, would drive me crazy.
So many things. I'd love you to rhapsodize on the pleasure of his company. What it's like to be with him. What's going on there on that brilliant surface and hidden too?
I don't think he actually has much surface. It is a kind of remarkable thing to have a president just sort of drop into your life like that. You know, suddenly here comes the airplane and here comes the microphone. You know, it's really not something that you expect. But I've had talked with him before, and on the basis of that, I felt a very deep affinity with him, not because of any obvious likeness, but because he's very readable. Hmm. He anticipates when a courtesy might be required. He's ahead of you in that way, you know, but always in this very attentive, generous, accurately imaginative sort of way. I've never met anybody like that. He's just extraordinary.
You wrote that Obama is ours in the deep sense that Lincoln is ours, a proof, a test, and an instruction. We see ourselves in him, and in him we embrace or reject what we are. Expand on that.
One of the things that I think is remarkable when you think about American history is how much it's a thing of language, you know? Mm. How much the great moments and the great turning points, really, in history are associated with a great speech. The best presidents are highly articulate men. You know, there's an America that sort of transcends America, and it's carried along on this special poetry of collective understanding. There's a verse in a psalm that says, the Lord is enthroned on the songs of Israel. And I think there's a certain way in which America is enthroned on these highest speeches that are a sort of an aesthetic realization of an idea that gives it twice the power of the idea or 10 times. Obama speaks that language. He's in that tradition, in that heritage. The day that we stop recognizing it when we hear it, when the old music actually becomes inaudible to us, that will probably be the place where America, in every sense it's ever liked to think of itself, will in fact expire.
What lines, for example, will you remember out of his best speeches?
Well, you know, I probably never forget his Amazing Grace speech. I laugh because he mentioned my name in it, which startled me to death. Made
no wonder you laugh, and I love it when you laugh.
Well, I mean, it was a very solemn and moving address, but he was speaking in that very specific circumstance of a hideous event, one that had the sulfur of our darkest moments clinging to it. He's a very pious man. I don't have any doubt that he's a deeply religious man.
Mm.
And that great structure of grace, which can absorb, you know, unimaginable things, as had already been demonstrated by the people in that church who had forgiven the criminal. He has a theological vision. He resolves things into a larger frame of meaning than people ordinarily do. He has that amazing kind of serenity of his, which, exhausted as he must be, seems always to remain untouched. I think it's because he takes a very large view of everything. It's really a very beautiful way to think of things. It's theological by my lights in the sense that it steps completely outside ordinary categories of success or significance or the nobility of everyone doing what is required. It's just very strong to him.
Amazing grace. How sweet the sound.
That was the novelist Marilyn Robinson. Coming up, another master of language, David Bromwich, Sterling Professor of English at Yale, an Obama volunteer in 2008. And then in 2009, he started noticing something amiss in the president's words. This is Open Source. David Bromwich is a literary critic and analyst who's made a second career close reading politics and politicians, like a book, quite literally, every word tested chemically under a microscope. Among eminent liberals, David Bromwich was a warning voice of reservations and then disappointment in President Obama.
There is a graciousness about him that's really there. I perceive other qualities as well, egotism, for example. But he has grace of that kind, lowercase g. Mm-hmm. I think that's what people are going to miss. I should say, I wasn't smitten with him. He didn't enchant me. But I saw the qualities of measured speech and a way of carrying himself that showed respect for the kind of people he would want to have admire him. He seemed to want to raise the audience in their own estimation. And that was a fine thing. But even in that first campaign, he got caught up in long, drawn-out efforts to try to persuade people of positions he was taking that he thought, you know, just made sense, and that it was impossible for anyone to understand him, his moderate, charitable, good sense, and not agree with him. And that, I would say, rational, intellectual approach to political argumentation was an odd feature of it. It came out, you might remember those discussions he had with the voter who was nicknamed Joe the Plumber.
Right.
Out on the trail, they had a drawn-out conversation. And Obama started to have in it, it lasted longer than it need have done, a sort of pleading, almost plaintive voice. There's a rise and fall to it where he says, can't you understand? Wouldn't anybody agree with this? I mean, can't we really do this? In the tone of voice he used when he would tell the Republican Congress, my daughters, Malia and Sasha, have done their homework. Why can't you do your homework? This is an unusual way for a politician to be talking, and it showed a real aversion from conflict and a real aversion from disagreement. Mm-hmm. And then when one went back to look at his earlier career as an organizer, which seems to be a highly, on the face of it, a highly partisan and challenging line of work, maybe tougher than political argument, it started to come out that Obama had really avoided the confrontation part of community organizing and had avoided it very steadily. So this was the comment made on his 3 years there in Chicago by the people who worked with him. Everybody liked him, but there were no signal victories and there were no important disputes that he played a leading part in. So this started to become evident, I think, even on the campaign trail. But where it really came out was when he first had to endure partisan attack by the Republicans, led by, from the outside, by Dick Cheney, attack on his decision to release the first set of photos connected with abuse of prisoners by American intelligence officers, and then he was thinking of releasing a second set. And he ended up making a speech called the National Archives Speech in May 2009, in which he vowed to continue the policy of having a category of permanent detainees, of people who were, as he said, impossible to put on trial but too dangerous to release. Well, that was a major concession. That was a major buckling of constitutional principle, and he did it, we don't know, in response to what pressures, but he did it under pressures, some of which were visible. And I think from there on, Obama's role as a polite, gracious, soft voice caretaker of the security state and the national intelligence and war regime started to emerge. But he was going to keep up a great preponderance of the Bush and Cheney policies. That's what I looked at first, because it seems to me foreign policy sets the limits to what is possible in domestic policy. So there's conflicting sorts of testimony or evidence you could look at. But I think when it comes to confronting and arguing against his enemies in a scene of conflict, and I mean political conflict within America, he never liked that and never did it very well and changed gears a lot. He could be aggressive, he could be rather passive, he could be silent for whole stretches. There was something irregular about the conduct as well as this general feeling of aversion.
David Brumbidge, you noticed early on something funny about his language. He might have spent too much time in foundation boardrooms or talking to foundation people, all of them smart, all of them good-willed, all of them certified, but it's a different role.
Yeah, it comes out in a way he can end up phrasing things that seems sanded at the edges, softened, a little bit muffled, lacking in vividness or sharpness where you might most need it. There's a long interview with him published in The Atlantic Online by Ta-Nehisi Coates, who was a journalist, an African-American journalist, who was early on a pretty radical critic of Obama's, but by the end had become an almost total admirer in the course of actually becoming a friend of Obama's, too, being invited to the White House more than once and so on. So they're talking about the possible inconsistency between setting oneself up as a disciple of Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King, which Obama did, and being the commander-in-chief in charge of drone strikes and other policies of state terror. So Coates asks him about this, and Obama's answer, I'm just going to read it because it typifies the sort of euphemistic language you're talking about. He says, if I were not comfortable with the judicious use of our military to protect the American people, then I shouldn't have run for president. And having said that, I do think that the wisdom of a King or a Gandhi can inform my decisions. I may not be able to follow their beliefs to their logical conclusions. Well, the logical conclusions is nonviolence. But I can think about what Gandhi said or King said about violence begetting violence and still be true to my job by asking myself the question whether we're confronted with a situation where some may be arguing, notice a lot of words there, some may be arguing for military action. Will this actually result in America being safer or the most lives being saved? So he connects himself in lineal descent with these great, and you might even say in their case, saintly advocates of nonviolence, Gandhi and King, by virtue of the fact that he feels comfortable with a judicious use of our military. I just can't imagine either Gandhi or King in any context whatever using that word comfortable. But the main trouble with this way of talking is that Obama ends up finding he can square the circle and make the judicious use of violence, that is to say, expedience, let me not kill more innocent people. Let me not kill more non-Americans than is absolutely necessary, which is what any decent and self-restrained president ought to be asking himself. He can do that and then say, and this marks me as a disciple of Gandhi and King. Well, it's a way of talking so difference-splitting, so moderate, that meaning has kind of evaporated from categories that ought to be pretty hard and fast.
David Burmich, looking back, there's a sense of just losing Barack Obama inch by inch over 8 years. Where did that transnational piece that knows Gandhi, that addressed the crowd in Berlin, fellow citizen of the world, when did we lose that?
There was a misperception, or I should say a mistaken perception about Obama, which I shared in, which is that he was dissident in some way by temperament. Once he got into office, he told people flat, I'm not. I'm a moderate. He seemed to be running as a reformer, as a serious liberal, radical reformer. And then you find that the people he's closest to, the people who give him his economic team, build it up and so on, are Michael Froman, Jason Furman, Peter Orszag, and then the team gets to be Geithner and Summers. And essentially you have one more Wall Street into the White House administration. Mm. And that didn't seem contradictory to Obama from what he knew of himself, but it was, it certainly stood in contrast to what we saw advertised up until he announced his economic team in the fall of 2008.
I'm just struck looking back how early it was that he made that remark to the bankers in the bailout controversy.
I'm the only thing standing between you and the pitchforks, but I'm on your side.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, Ron Suskind talked about that in his book on Obama and the economy. When I read that book, I was very struck by that moment. I thought, and according to Suskind, they went away practically rejoicing, but very surprised that he'd let them off the hook so easily. There is a strange and I think unfortunate relationship that this very deliberate man has to the passage of time. Obama, there's a sense of him always saying a bit too little or too much, too early or too late. And this is the case with his actions, too. Obamacare took an absurdly long time to pass through Congress. Mm-hmm. And some of that time was spent waiting for one Republican vote to come over. And this was a very public work of waiting. Nothing came of it. But, you know, that was time lost from the first 2 years of his first term that he could never get back. I mean, that's one example. There are lots of other examples one could give. He didn't respond immediately by saying he was going to propose legislation, even given the outlines of it, when he was so shocked, really shocked, and I think this was the man, not just the president, being moved by the slaughter at Sandy Hook. Mm. But he said, I'm going to send President Biden out to do a study, and in a month he's going to report back. Well, by a month later, the National Rifle Association, strong enough in any case, had rallied their forces, and there was no way that serious gun legislation was going to get passed.
David, speak to this unifying impulse, which it is his reflex. Wake him up in the middle of the night, he will want to bring people together. In the press, I noticed that one of the first things he did in Washington in the transition was had dinner with David Brooks and Charles Krauthammer and a lot of other right-of-center Iraq war hawks. It applied to Congress. It applied to almost everything. Is that in his childhood, in his DNA? Is it a conception of politics, price of inexperience? Or explain it.
It's the kind of politician he is. When you say his childhood, maybe you mean the fact that his father left and his mother, after some years, deposited him with grandparents. Well, I'm just trying to get off the hook myself as I do a little cheap psychoanalysis. Clearly, he has wanted to be a conciliatory force, but that's also just the order of his personality. His 2004 speech to the Democratic Convention spoke about we're one nation, we're not red and blue, we're a United States. My feeling when you got to 2008, 2009 and the financial collapse and some perception of who's really responsible for it and the need for radical reform was that Obama was someone, the idea and the, so to speak, image of the voice of Lincoln is often in his mind. He talks about it a lot. He compares himself with Lincoln a lot.
Right.
And one knows this. So he has been forever trying to give and hoping to be effective at giving the second inaugural, you know, with malice toward none, with charity for all, to bind up the nation's wounds and so on. But it was a moment much closer to the moment of the House Divided speech. And you can't keep giving that reconciliatory post-war speech with a euphemistic and gentle rhetoric appropriate to a magnanimous victor in a war. Hmm. Obama wanted to be the magnanimous victor and conciliator before he even fought a contest. And that's a temperamental quirk so strange. In one thing I wrote about it, I just called it an idée fixe delusion. The clinical definition of delusion is a fixed false idea. And I do believe this is behind many other people's sense that there's something messianic about Obama that really is not quite of this world and not quite having corrected perception of his role in the world, the feeling that he was born to be in this role, the fixed false idea that he could be the unifier. Another way it came out in a very strange sequence of comments that he made before the 2010 midterm, before the 2012 re-election campaign, before the 2014 midterm. He kept saying about the Tea Party, by that time, the sort of driving force of the Republican Party, the fever will break. I'm sure the Republican fever will break. And it's only a couple months after the 2014 midterm where, having now lost, after 2016, the Democrats have lost 900 seats in state legislatures and 65, I think it is, in the House of Representatives and 13 in the Senate. These are catastrophic losses for the Democrats as an opposing party. But only after 2014 does he say, I was wrong to say the fever would break. Mm-hmm. What would make one continue to think that against all the evidence? It was a kind of delusion. It was, if you will, a kindly delusion. But it did not help his politics.
David, the Lincoln mine is deep. You're a Lincoln scholar. I remember the picture of him, Obama, carrying a wonderful book that I was reading at the same time on Lincoln, the biography of a writer, when he was writing his own first inaugural speech. Make more of the connections, disconnections in the whole Lincoln thing.
Lincoln was remarkable to the point of being miraculous among modern politicians, not just Americans, in being able to coordinate words that he spoke with actions he was meditating and actions that he performed. And the words were of two kinds. One was to explain a policy, such as the policy of the Republican Party of the late 1850s, which was no extension of slavery, not abolition, but no extension of slavery. But Lincoln had inklings already that that might well mean abolition. Explaining a policy and then justifying it in the course of executing it, and then afterwards explaining what the policy had meant. He did that, for example, concerning the role of black troops on the Union side in the Civil War. So there's not exactly a match, but a rational, intelligible, quite lucid coordination between words and actions. And the actions are large, and they are actions for which he as executive takes responsibility. I mean, of course, the largest of all is the Emancipation Proclamation. But the fighting of the war is a so extended an action, one doesn't even know how to describe it as a single action. Obama loves words, has spoken perhaps more words than any other president while in office. Since losing the election, since Clinton's loss of the election, he's given very full-length interviews to David Remnick and Jonathan Chait and George Stephanopoulos and Ta-Nehisi Coates. Has any other president after his party lost an election on the way out given that many interviews or given that many? Anyway, he loves words is the point. The words are not coordinated with things he is actually doing in policy. And you often got a whole new category of speech, which was the speech that expressed his preference but begged off performance of the promise that that might seem to imply. Hmm. So, for example, when there started to be controversy about civilian deaths from drone strikes, all of which Obama had to approve and which began with his man in the White House, John Brennan, Obama made a heartfelt, I guess, but also rather prudent, carefully held back speech, saying it's terribly regrettable that we have to do things like this, and sometime this will have to stop, and it's not who we are as a people. How he loved that phrase, who we are as a people. It's not who we are as a people, but I have to do it, and I'm going to go on doing it. Well, it seems wrong for a president both to say he doesn't want to do something and sees all the reasons against it, and then say, but I'm going to go on doing it against my will. Considering how strong the president is and what a unique position of power he occupies, not only in the U.S., but in the world, it's just an almost aberrant habit of speech to say, I don't like it, I'm against it, but I'm doing it. It's not that that doesn't happen. Of course that happens in politics. Politicians do many deeply distasteful things, but they don't say, this is not to my taste, this isn't the real me, and then do it. Obama's always presenting his real self, wanting to be admired for that, wanting to be, if you will, magnified and sanctified for what he is. But what he does as president is what we ought to judge him by.
That was David Bromwich at Yale. His last book, new in paperback, is The Moral Imagination. Coming up, what was, what wasn't, what might have been, with Randall Kennedy, who wrote The Persistence of the Color Line about the 2008 campaign, and the clairvoyant young pundit Nathan Robinson, who wrote early on that Barack Obama had set a sort of trap for himself in 2016. This is Open Source. Do we begin to understand the Obama years yet? Our guest, Randall Kennedy, teaches law where Barack Obama learned it. Nathan Robinson is an aspiring sociologist who had the audacity a year ago to start a new, glossy, dissident magazine called Current Affairs, and he saw 2016 unfolding pretty much as it has. Randy Kennedy, you taught a real-time course on race in the 2008 campaign, and you saw Obama's canny, deft navigation of a rocky stream as a candidate. How about his president?
Well, in 2008, I felt great admiration for him. And now that he's leaving, I feel great admiration for him. I think I feel admiration, first of all, he showed tremendous insight. He thought that a black person could become president of the United States. Now, there were a bunch of people who did not think that, but he thought that he could. He thought that that was possible. He went for it, and he won, and he had two presidential campaigns in which I think he showed himself to be a thoughtful, well-spoken, well-read, deeply humane person. He becomes president of the United States, and I think he has governed in a way that serious, humane doesn't mean that, you know, he did everything right. I think there's plenty of room for people to be critical of him, but he never embarrassed himself. He never embarrassed the country. I thought that he comported himself like one would want a president of the United States to comport himself.
So how are we feeling? Let's get to it.
Well, I feel sadness. I mean, in fact, at this moment, sadness is actually too pale a word. I mean, there has never been since Lincoln's time. You were talking about Lincoln earlier in the program. Mm. Lincoln gave way through assassination to Andrew Johnson. Now, that was quite a drop in quality of person, frankly. Barack Obama tomorrow will give way to Donald Trump. That is a declension of extraordinary. That's a very steep drop, and it's a drop that brings sadness to me.
It brings outrage among black friends of mine, I must say. I mean, how could you do it? Follow that beautiful man with this monster.
I feel that way, I think. But, you know, in part, yeah, I feel that way. It has made me interpret the Obama presidency differently. I mean, this is a shadow over his presidency. The fact of the matter is, and again, I've already expressed my admiration for him, but the fact of the matter is, he put himself on the line. He said to the country, you know, please, for my sake, don't put this man in the White House. And he was repudiated. And indeed, the person who was going to take his place derided him. taunted him. I mean, this is a repudiation that's quite extraordinary, and I'm deeply worried about it.
Nathan Robinson, the headline on your new issue is "Are We Doomed?" I pay attention because your first issue, almost a year ago, saw so much of this coming, and very specifically, the thought, and Randy's mentioning it, that Hillary Clinton, the Obama choice, was maybe the only Democrat that Donald Trump could beat. What were they missing?
Well, there's what Obama was missing, and then there's what the Democratic Party was missing. I mean, I think one of the fundamental problems with Obama is that he doesn't really believe in politics. He does believe in this, there's no red America, there's no blue America, we're all one sort of thing. And it turns out there is a red America, and the red America is very angry, and the red America is ready to hit back at you. And so it was fundamentally on Obama's part a sort of naive view that suggests there are no such thing as conflicting interests, there is no competition, whereas Donald Trump has a view that everything is a competition and you have to beat the other guy and you have to crush him. And then, you know, Hillary Clinton is a more cynical person. I mean she's more seasoned politician. I think they, on the sort of Clintonite Democratic politics, underestimated how successful Donald Trump is as a marketer, as a strategist, and as a businessman, and how much of what he does is a con man act rather than something that you can easily dismiss as clownish and foolish.
Dare I say, Randy, when you describe the long shot that Barack Obama bet his life on, there's a certain symmetry with Donald Trump. Who says Donald Trump can't get elected president? I'll show you. And Obama had been through the same impossible feat.
That's absolutely true. I mean, remember his speech the night that he became president-elect. Barack Obama says, you know, anything is possible in the United States. Well, 8 years later, that is substantiated with the ascension of Donald Trump. That's right. Anything is possible.
Watch me leap over that flagpole. I'm going to do it. You say it can't be done. And they did it. So are we doomed or are we not, Nathan?
No, well, I mean, I asked the question, are we doomed in the magazine, but
How bad is it? You're pretty strong anti-Trump.
Well, the frightening thing is that we don't know, right? The frightening thing is that we put our fate in the hands of Donald Trump, and that whether we turn out to be doomed or not, as I say, turns out to hinge on who he turns out to be. What turns out to be beneath this act that he's been putting on, whether he's a pretty typical conservative Republican and is just going to pass the Republican agenda. I mean, he could be like Ronald Reagan. That's the sort of best case scenario, is that he's just a guy putting on an act. The worst case scenario is obviously very bad. He turns out to be a kind of authoritarian strongman figure. He's already talking about putting on military parades. And so we don't know. And it's the fact that we don't know. It's the uncertainty that's so deeply frightening.
I want to say the race question is profound, and it's not Barack Obama is doing. Toni Morrison struck a strong note in the New Yorker post-election. She said, unlike any nation in Europe, the United States holds whiteness as the unifying force. Here, for many people, the definition of Americanness is color, and people are ready to murder for it, as in the Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown or Eric Garner, so many cases. Do we believe this, Randy?
Well, I don't think that race is everything. There's lots of things going on. There was the class element. There was a poorly run campaign by Hillary Clinton. There were lots of different things going on, including just dumb luck. But was the race element an appreciable, a substantial part of this? Absolutely. Absolutely. And part of what's going on, and part of what's been going on for 8 years, is a reaction against a black president and an effort to, put certain people back in their place. Now, you know, there's some people who would say, I'm thinking of my father of blessed memory.
Please. I always listen for your father's voice in yours, Randy.
My father was deeply pessimistic about the United States on the race question, and what he would have said was, Barack Obama becoming president of the United States, now that's the exception. That was the miracle.
Hmm.
That would have surprised him greatly. The ascension of Donald Trump, if he were alive today, my father would be saying, this is the real America. This is what actually one should expect.
Hmm. Come back to Obama's thinking. Strikes me the sort of radical centrism, almost obsessive centrism, is a deep part of there's something lazy about it. There's something kept about it. In a time when our economy and our role in the world are so out of joint, to cling to the center, and he did from the beginning, and I didn't pick it up. I got to acknowledge, you know, Matt Taibbi did in 2007. He wrote wonderfully in Rolling Stone. He described Obama's political vision as an amalgam, listen, of Kennedy, Reagan, Clinton, and the New Deal. He's aiming for the middle of the middle of the middle. And it turned out that's the way he governed. And I think it was mistaken. The country needed a turn. And I don't know why he didn't, or how he didn't feel it.
Well, on this, it seems to me now, the race part really is very important. This guy was seeking to become the first black president of the United States. I liken him in politics to Jackie Robinson in mm-hmm. baseball. When Jackie Robinson broke in, they told Jackie Robinson, listen, that's right, you're going to be called names, don't answer back, they're going to be spiking you, they're going to be doing all sorts of things. You have to behave in a certain way.
And Branch Rickey chose him for those qualities.
That's right. That's right. Incredibly dignified, disciplined. Barack Obama, I'm sure, felt that there were simply certain things that he could not do. I think that he, you know, over a long period of time, had developed an internal discipline, which showed itself politically as this, you know, this centrism. I think that was part of how he became president of the United States.
Mm. What about the centrism? I mean, I still think of you as a sort of oracle, Nathan, but you sensed, no, we're at a turn.
Well, one of the things that, as well about Obama and race, though, is that he doesn't fundamentally share that pessimistic view of race in America. And partially it may be to do with his background. I mean, this is what Ta-Nehisi Coates identifies, is that he suggests that he didn't have the ordinary black experience.
He had a blessed childhood. For
so
sure.
For him, he always saw being black as something cool and positive. And so he didn't have the experience of ever being hate, like he didn't really recognize that people despised him on the other side, that he could be despised.
If they did, yeah.
That there would be raw feelings of hatred in the country. And so it has taken him a very long time to accept that there is such a thing as a hatred that you cannot reason with. And it's really hurt him ultimately. And you can say, well, he doesn't understand that there are conflicting interests, and Republicans are different.
What might have changed that course? An emphasis on jobs in the first term, maybe, instead of healthcare, or what?
Well, I mean, one of the things is if he'd recognized that there are conflicting interests in the world, that Republicans and Democrats believe different things.
And it's a battlefield, yes.
They have different conceptions of what the role of government is and what society should look like. And then he would have understood what rising inequality means, what the decline of the labor movement actually meant, which was the decline of the labor movement and his failure to get behind the Employee Free Choice Act actually meant that Democratic political power would be eroded in the long run. And that you needed a fighting Democratic political force if you were going to beat the Republicans. But Obama doesn't believe in beating Republicans. He believes in persuading, sitting down with, negotiating, getting the smart people in a room. So if he'd changed that conception, if he'd seen politics as more of a struggle and seen the necessity of reducing inequality, bringing jobs to people, and rebuilding labor, that might have made a difference.
Randy Kennedy, what would you have done differently? How would you have told him?
I wish that he had worked more on ideological education. When he appointed judges, for instance, his predecessor, George Bush, said straightforwardly, I'm going to appoint conservative judges and justices. And he underlined conservative and he valorized it. and made being a conservative jurist a good thing. Mm. Barack Obama, along with other, you know, Democrats, they didn't talk about appointing liberal judges. They muffled that. I'm going to appoint just judges. He actually sounded in his last speech, Founding fathers. He sounded like an originalist. I'm sure that Justice Scalia would have been very happy to have heard him talk about the founding fathers so much. Hmm. You know, my old boss, Thurgood Marshall, when he talked about the founding fathers, he said, well, the founding fathers were okay, but, you know, what really brought freedom and equality and, you know, to America was Reconstruction. Not the founding fathers. So I think that he did miss opportunities to actually push things. Voting over the past 8 years, there has been an obvious, blatant attack on voting rights across the country. It seems to me that would have been a wonderful thing for a presidential address.
Yeah.
But we didn't hear that.
But it's a fight you have to have, and you have to fundamentally believe that it's a fight, that people are trying to take away voting rights. And I think Obama finds that hard to accept. I mean, Obama's ideal jurist is someone like Merrick Garland, someone like Elena Kagan, and not necessarily Thurgood Marshall. So he believes in putting people who are moderate, who see both sides, who share this conception that we can resolve all of our conflicts and we can all live in peace and harmony together.
I want to worry about us a minute. I mean, was this the last oasis of sanity, dignity in presidential discourse for the longest time, for our lifetimes?
I certainly hope not, but I've already said I'm very fearful. And by the way, on the question of what's to come, a lot of bad things have already happened. The fact of the matter is there has already been grievous undermining of certain democratic norms. I mean, when you talk about your opponent, When you threaten your opponent, if I win, I'm going to appoint somebody to prosecute you. That's right. Now, he's taken it back somewhat, but the fact of the matter is that was a threat that was made. There were other, I'm not going to accept the outcome unless the outcome goes my way. Those were very basic attacks on democratic norms, and you know, that's out there. That's a toxin in the water. It's going to take a long time to get over that.
Nathan Robinson, define doom and give us some odds here. What would it look like?
Well, I mean, there are some really obvious forms of doom, right, where we face a true catastrophe on the climate change front, and the threat of nuclear conflict is really deeply alarming at this point, and the fact that there are no controls, essentially, on what Trump does on that front. I mean, that is a civilization-ending potential threat. Then there's the erosion of democratic political power. Right? There's the existential threat to humanity, and then there's a series of comparatively more moderate threats, which is the full-scale institution of the Republican agenda in government, essentially the shutting down of federal government functions, the privatization of essentially everything, a more aggressive and hawkish foreign policy that will bring a lot of harm to people. So those were what the stakes are.
Last word, Randy Kennedy. What do you want from this man now, our friend Obama?
I want Obama to tell people to organize and to resist and to uphold the best in America. He's talked about the best in America. We're going to need that more than ever now.
Randy Kennedy and Nathan Robinson, thank you both. Thanks also to Marilyn Robinson and David Bromwich. If you're in Boston on February 4th, the wise comic Jimmy Tingle will be doing his Humor for Humanity at Sanders Theater in Cambridge. Use the code OPENSOURCE when you buy your ticket, and you'll help our cause too. Our show was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, and Becca DiGregorio. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.